You walk into organizations and I'm sure you've had people on this show that we have a culture of winning, we have a culture of innovation, we have a culture of learning. It's not just a one-time event though, right? You can't just say I have a culture of learning and have it be true, right? That this is a process, and you said that very well earlier. But you've got to make sure that the people you're hiring value those things that you're putting up on your wall, that you're saying is your culture, because everybody needs to pay rent right now. Everybody needs to buy groceries right now. Gas is expensive. Everything's super expensive. People are putting up with a mismatch in culture a lot right now because they need that paycheck.
Welcome to Verify Infield, the Millwork Podcast. Your host, Jacob Edmond, CEO of Duckworks, will be interviewing experts in the industry to bring you insights and knowledge about the latest trends, techniques, and challenges in millwork. Whether you're a seasoned professional or just starting out, this podcast is for you. So sit back, relax, and join us as we explore the world of millwork. Here's Jacob.
Welcome back, everybody, to Verify Infield. Today, I have a guest, Jim Mayer, who is the host of his own podcast, Manufacturing Culture Podcast. I'm excited to have him on today talking about manufacturing culture, a little bit of a diversity, and hopefully having a little bit of a different vantage point from the manufacturing broader than just millwork. So thanks for joining today, Jim.
Yeah, thank you, Jacob. Appreciate you having me on. Very excited to be on this podcast, and hopefully somebody takes something away. I mean, that's the hope every time we have these things, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So maybe to get started, I think if you could share a little bit about your career path, what led you to manufacturing industry, and then inspire you to become an advocate for culture in manufacturing?
Yeah, great question. And I love telling this story. So if I get too long, just let me know and give me the hook from the stage left or something. So I actually started my career in skilled trades in the construction field. I went to college for 1 year out of high school, quickly realized that university was not for me. So I went back home after trying, working in bars and service industry and stuff like that. Floating around in that world for a couple of years, I went back home and got into building houses, custom log homes. I grew up in northwestern Colorado, outside of a town called Steamboat Springs. We moved to Denver when I went to high school. And so my dad moved back up there after my brother and I were gone and built a house, and he needed help building that house. And I was done in the restaurant and service industry. And I said, oh, come check it out. I'll help you out. And so I learned the ropes building my dad's house. After that, was quickly hired on by another construction company up in that area. Got to build some amazing houses, do a lot of fun demo, stuff like that. In the midst of my building career, had fallen off of one too many roofs, and my body just couldn't take the impact that I was and the toll that I was putting on anymore. So one of our distributors had come to the job site and asked me why I was literally killing myself on these job sites. We weren't the safest of crew. That's why I didn't mention the company name. Said, you can sell all these things that I sell. You know all of these products. Why don't you come work for us? And I said, oh, at your facility in Steamboat, Hayden? And he said, no, actually, I'll bring you a list of all the openings. So he brought me a list of all the openings. I saw California. Never lived in California. I was a young guy. Said, oh, that sounds pretty cool. So packed up, applied for the job, got the job, packed up all my stuff, moved to Long Beach, California. And that's where I started my career in industrial sales. And that's when I walked into my first machine shop. A facility called West Coast Aerospace in Wilmington, California. It was infectious. The sights, the smells, the sounds of this place was just amazing. And so I quickly started changing my focus from construction sales to more industrial sales and manufacturing sales, and spending more time in manufacturing facilities in the LA Long Beach area. And I loved it. I loved what people were able to make, take material, make different things. Needed to learn more about the industry. I ended up leaving that company and went and worked for a sensor company, industrial sensor company called Keyence. Sold go, no go sensors for them, and was then recruited by another industrial distributor who I worked for almost a dozen years. Worked in California, moved my family to Phoenix, Arizona, sold here. Career really took off, but I was really tired of chasing that corporate rat race, and found an organization called found the NTMA, which is the National Tooling and Machining Association, and worked for them. Went and worked for them on the advocacy side of manufacturing. And to answer your question, that's really where I found a passion for standing up for manufacturers, helping manufacturers get the things that they need to really progress. And it was more of a national scope at that point. So I was doing that job and learning a lot from different kinds of machine shops and manufacturing facilities. When I started hearing the same question and comments over and over again about, we can't find people. Why can't I find people that want to come work here? What am I doing wrong? Things of that nature. And so I started looking at employee engagement metrics for a lot of these companies and helping them understand that while they were good companies, they still treated their people like, in some cases, like it was 1950 and paid them like it was 1970. And in order to get people in the door to want to come work, not only did they have to treat their people right, but they needed to pay them appropriately. And then I started learning even more about what was driving people to come work for these organizations by doing these engagement surveys. And I found that it was things like leadership. Was a big deal. And this was all pre-COVID. This was, 2017, 18, and 19. Leadership was a big deal. It wasn't pizza parties. It wasn't always pay. It wasn't really things that we had been talking about in the industry about how you retain and recruit people. It was things, again, like leadership. But even bigger than that, it was the values of the organization. It was connecting the individual's values, the employee values, with the values of the organization. It was taking things like saying, hey, we make hip replacements at this facility. Would you like to help grandma or grandpa be able to stand again? It's, if you're passionate about flying and planes, and then why don't you go make aerospace parts? If you're passionate about the war machine, go make defense parts. So that's where I really found that love for what my definition and some others' definition of culture is, and how manufacturers can really change their culture to fit the environment that they want to recruit the people that they need to fill the jobs that they have. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
So then I through that project, I left the NTMA at the end of 2019, went and worked for an organization in Chicago called Big Kaiser at the time. Now they're Big Daishoa, and helped them through a change management project, helped them navigate the waters of transitioning from one president, who was their legacy president, to their now current president. And ran their sales team for their tool measurement and management division. And at the end of 2 years with them, they needed my career to go one way. I needed it to go another. So we split very amicably. And I launched what is TCO Strategies, which is my consulting business where I go and I help manufacturers of various verticals, right? Textile, of course, precision machining, food and beverage, any real vertical within manufacturing, help them identify the culture that they have and determine what kind of culture they want. And then I help them draw a roadmap to get there. Through that process is when the podcast was born. I had sent out an email to a lot of different people in the industry, cold email campaign, trying to generate interest in soft skills trainings and things of that nature that I also offer. And I got a lot of negative responses to that because, you know, soft skills don't belong in manufacturing was something that I heard a lot from that campaign, which is not true. It very much does. But for every four or five of those negative emails I got back, I got one or two back from somebody saying, we've got an amazing company culture. Here's what we do. Here's how we do it. And I started calling these owners, these supervisors, these managers, these employees, and hearing their stories about the company cultures that they had and how they'd built them and how they were helping change their lives and their outlook and everything like that. And it was amazing. It was phenomenal. And I was telling a friend this story at the WIM, Women in Manufacturing Summit in Atlanta in the fall of 2022. She said, sounds like you're starting a podcast. And I said, not a chance. I am not a podcaster. I have no intention of ever becoming a podcaster. And she said, nope, I challenge you to do it. And so 2 months later, I announced on LinkedIn that I was starting a podcast and quickly booked the first 12 guests or so. And it's been fun ever since. I'm 63 episodes in. You know, covering a wealth of different verticals, again, different types of manufacturing. But we tell the stories of people in the industry, the owners that are second generation, the employees that have found a place in manufacturing that they never thought they'd have anywhere else. This month in April, we're telling the stories of different mission-driven organizations. We're talking with an organization called Lighthouse for the Blind, JARC, the Jane Addams Resource Corporation. We're talking with Rise Up Industries, which is an organization that takes previously incarcerated people and teaches them how to be machinists. And these are all organizations that are helping fill the skills gap in their own very unique ways. So it's been a blast, Jacob, having a lot of fun with it. And everybody's got a story to tell in this industry. And we talk a lot about the technology. We talk a lot about different aspects, but not a whole lot of people talk about the human aspect of this industry. And those stories are what's going to be the magnet to get the next generation interested in this career. And even some people who are mid career and want to change in their lives, they're now looking at our industry as well.
No, I think that's awesome. You know, and ultimately why I reached out to connect with you, because I think we're very much kindred spirits in that, you know, there's a lot of very similar timeline and journey for me starting this podcast and very similar goals is to talk to the people and share the stories, because, you know, as I spent the last 2 years really going out and consulting with this industry, kind of I spent time in industry working in several companies. And then now the last 2 years, I've really got exposed to how big the millwork manufacturing industry is and how many different people there are. And really that being the key, you know, there's a lot of talk and has been about technology and industry 4.0 and all this move towards automation and stuff. And there's plenty of content out there for that, right?
Absolutely.
But I think what's interesting to me, especially in the last year with AI and a lot of the software drive, it's almost like the pendulum is actually swinging back the other way. You know, we've seen the work Mike Rowe's done and about how we've gotten away from the trades. And now we're shifting back to where so much, like, we still need trades and manufacturing. There's stuff that has to happen here on our soil in the U.S. that can't, yeah. You can't offshore the installation of these products we make. You can't offshore so much of this work. You can't outsource it, but you can now replace a lot of the technical stuff with AI, with software, with a lot of the people that can work remotely and do it overseas, right? And so we're valuing more and more the people with the skills of these technical trades and the manufacturing than like the pendulum swinging back the other way. Yeah. And the struggles, as you mentioned, with we still have a huge skills gap as a result of that, is that we've had a gap to where we've stopped. We don't have, unions and as much of a pipeline for manufacturing, for the trades as we once did. And so now we're having to figure that out again. How do we get young people into this industry to fill the roles that we need? And now the organizations that exist don't know how to speak to them, don't know how to get them in there, don't know how to get them interested, and they're not speaking to, like, what future are you providing for them? Why should they want to come work for you versus every other opportunity that exists? And so that's why it's so interesting to me that you focused on culture, because I've done 50-some-odd episodes of this now, and not a single one of them has started out with the intention to be a talk about culture, but almost every one of them has ended up that we talk about culture.
Absolutely.
It plays into everything, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I mean, going back to your point, about offshoring jobs, there's a direct correlation, Jacob, with how post-World War II, we built this country on skilled trades, which built up the middle class, right? Mm-hmm. And our economic prosperity post-World War II, because we had a robust middle class in this country, was unlike anything we'd ever seen before. And that resulted in the baby boomer generation, right? That 46 to 64 generation. Mm-hmm. And then when we started offshoring jobs, and again, regardless of vertical within this industry, once we started offshoring jobs, you can see a direct correlation with that contraction of the middle class, right? And when you have that contraction of the middle class, that's when economically our country has become weaker and weaker and weaker to where we are now, where we've got inflation. You've got more people who can't afford food than can afford food, right? You've got people who, you've got an entire generation of Z's who are not looking at being able to leave their parents' house when they graduate high school or university, right? We need, it's our responsibility as a country to really rebuild that middle class to create that economic prosperity that people can really live and survive again. And the only way we can do that is by bringing those trades back, by bringing more jobs back here. In order to do that, though, we do need a robust workforce. And right now, we skipped an entire generation of being able to show them in high school and junior high and some states, what manufacturing and skilled trades looks like, right? Mm-hmm. My high school was one of the few in our area that had a wood shop and a metal shop, but those closed shortly after I left high school. And they didn't come back to that high school until, I want to say, 2000. 2012. So you've got 15 years, you've got nearly an entire generation worth of people who did not have that opportunity to go through a trades program in high school. Here in Arizona, I know of three, I think, high schools that have CNC programs. We've got to fix those kinds of problems, right? We're not going to close that skills gap with humans if we're not providing them that exposure at a young age. You couple that with when that offshoring started happening, the closing of facilities, right? Baltimore, huge in the steel industry, right? Steel industry shut down, Bethlehem Steel shut down in Baltimore. You've got generations of people who hold a grudge against manufacturing because Bethlehem Steel shut down. Right. So not only are we fighting that perception of dark, dirty, dangerous, we're also fighting generational like grudges because of poverty, because of the way that certain industries, when they left this country, left the population of communities just hanging in the balance with nothing else to do.
We'll be back after a quick break.
You love listening to podcasts, but have you ever thought about starting your own podcast? Maybe you want to build a brand, grow your business, or are looking for an excuse to talk about your favorite hobby. Whatever your reason for making a podcast, Buzzsprout is the place to start. Since 2009, Buzzsprout has helped over 300,000 people launch their own podcasts. Buzzsprout walks you step by step through the whole process and will give you powerful tools to start, grow, and monetize your podcast. Ready to get started? Click the link in the show notes to get our free step-by-step guide to starting your podcast today.
Yeah. No, yeah, absolutely. And I think that that's what's, you know, because I went to school for architecture, right? And for me, it was one of these industries that it was very, I left architecture school very jaded to it, right? Because architecture is one of these fields that's, you know, we talked about recently in another episode, it's very sexy,
yeah.
Right? It's something that people are proud to say they do, even if you're not making very much money, which most of my peers that went to school there came out of there and they're not making very good money. And that takes them, you know, on par, if not more years than to be a doctor,
yeah.
To be a licensed architect. And still, you know, it's like a musician. There's some rock star architects, but the majority of it, you know, you're not making a lot of money.
Yep.
And I think it's like the military, you know, like we've done the best thing we ever did was make it something to be proud of, to be glorified, that we don't actually reward them,
yep.
correspondingly to the work they do, the service they provide. And so, but in our industry, I'm like, I made a much greater living going into a less glorified industry that nobody knows what it is I do.
Yeah.
That, you know, it's like, oh, what is that? Oh, you work in woodworking, so you're dirty all day. Well, no, not really, actually. There's one, even if I am, like, so what? But
yeah.
I think that's what's interesting is it's like, okay, so we have done ourselves a disservice in our industry of manufacturing. And I think that there's some marketing case studies out there to learn, like, how do we glorify our industry and make it, like, appealing? That's what we need to do. Like, hey, look, guys,
yeah.
You're not just going to go and work in a dirty shop all day for 40 years, like what you think of as manufacturing of our grandparents, right?
Right.
There's a career to be had here, and there's a whole plethora of opportunities to apply your skills that are needed.
Yeah.
You know, like, and we get to do some pretty cool stuff
yeah.
and that we don't talk about enough. So I think that's what's interesting, you know, from the culture side is, that obviously there's a lot of work to be done focusing inwardly, but even more so, I think, outward.
Absolutely. And so let me ask you a question, Jacob, because I got into this conversation the other day. You brought up Mike Rowe. My stance on Mike Rowe, I love Mike Rowe. I think he's a badass, right? I think he's done a lot of great things for the skilled trades. But I also think the show Dirty Jobs did more harm for skilled trades than it did positive things, right? He glorified that dirty side of dirty jobs, right?
Yeah.
And really exploited that. And so that's part of the reason that you've got that entire generation. What do you think about that take?
No, I agree. I mean, I think, you know, I think that's what comes with any type of reality television. It's like,
sure.
They looked for this job is so dirty, nobody would want to do it. And that's why this guy's a millionaire and why you shouldn't feel bad that he did the hard work to get there.
Sure.
But you're not going to replicate that as opposed to, like, there's so many good channels out there that I think do a great job, you know, about our trades in general, like machine shops, for example, just the idea of being a machinist, right? And I think a lot of people think of, like, oh, you're in a dirty, you know, like, machine shops a lot of times are some of the most cleanest places you can go, right? And you look at so many industries that rely and dependent on them, and there's so much specialization in it and technology that most people don't even know exists.
Yeah.
You know, from a CNC, from a technology perspective. And I think also the people in these industries, the old timers, like I know I'll speak for woodworking and millwork. You know, when CNCs and stuff came in and there's so many older craftsmen that are like, that's not craft.
Yeah.
Like, oh, you're cheating. Like, that's not really what we do. and you're just telling a machine to do the work for you, ignoring the fact that you still have to know everything that you know as a craftsman, but now you need to be able to tell software and a machine to do those things. And a lot of times it's still not entirely there. Like, and it opens up so much more creativity, just like going from, you know, chisels and hand planes and things to routers and drills and, you know, that type of stuff. Like, it's an evolution of the tools, but the same premises are there, the same knowledge, if not more.
Yep.
And so I think we've got that now. Like, even when we have draft, like what I specialize in is drafting and design and there's always this struggle of like, oh, well, but you're never going to be a good drafter or designer if you haven't done all the work yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we have is a whole generation of right now, largely we're filled with late career drafters and designers who spent decades on the floor. And then they learn how to suddenly, okay, now I need to learn how to turn on a computer and translate my knowledge to a computer. But then they're really never great at either one.
Right.
Yep. And it's how do we pair that generational knowledge, that expertise, with people that are coming out of college knowing how to use technology from the day they were born.
Yeah.
And they can think and model in 3D and leverage that software like you know, they have a lifetime of experience. Pair that with the old timers that have that knowledge. How do we leverage that and not steer it away? Because right now, you take a young person out of college, you sit them down with a 20, 30-year veteran, and that 30-year veteran is, you know, like, is not, 9 times out of 10 is going to treat them like crap, and they're going to say, why am I in this industry? If everybody here doesn't want me here. They don't want to teach me. When I ask questions, they look at me like I'm an idiot.
Yep.
Like, what are we doing that are in this industry to, when that person does show up, keep them here? Like, make them interested. Hey, somebody's got to teach them. Because if I look back at my career, I can count so many names of people that came and gave me the opportunity, gave me their time, gave me their knowledge, invested in me, and they didn't have to. But because of that, I said, oh, I want to learn from this guy. Oh, I respect what he knows. And he gave me his time. I want to pass that forward.
Yeah.
But instead we focus on, oh, well, they don't have as hard as I do. You know, they're not having to go through and put in their time like I did.
Right.
We're gatekeeping the industry while complaining that nobody wants to join it.
So one thing that I've done, recently with a client, so far it's been very successful. Instead of pairing with that new entry, that apprentice, that recent graduate with that veteran, and saying to the veteran, I want you to mentor this newbie. We went the other direction. We asked the newbie to mentor the veteran on mm-hmm. how to adopt technology and use a knowledge transfer tool to extract the knowledge. So what the newbie did was go in with this knowledge of technology, with this knowledge of software, with the knowledge of everything that you and I are using to speak right now, right?
Yeah.
And sat down at a computer with this 25-year veteran and said, hey, here's this program. We need to extract all of your knowledge and put it in there. I'm not going to ask you to do this, but what I want to hear is I want to know all of your knowledge. So literally the newbie sat at the computer, transcribed, wrote, brought drawings in, did all that kind of stuff. The veteran is actually mentoring this young person without even knowing that they're mentoring, right? But at the same time, you're capturing all of that knowledge from that veteran for future new hires to then be able to digitally mentor the next hire and the next hire and the next hire. So it's all there in your system, right? Instead of having to say, hey, you're going to mentor this person. That being said, I do highly recommend using that older generation, that baby boomer generation within your facility for mentors. Not everybody's built to be a mentor, right? Yeah. And it's as leaders being able to identify, okay, which one is my good mentor? Which one has amazing amounts of knowledge that we need to extract? And pairing the people together well. And that's takes, it's an art in itself, is making sure that you're pairing those people together. But I'm a big advocate of making sure that, sometimes you're going to have the younger person mentor the older person on technology versus having the older person mentor the younger, if that makes sense at all.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I think this is also, you know, feeds into culture, because if those later career individuals, one, have insecurity for their position of like, I'm going to transfer this, all this knowledge, and then what value do I have here? Right. Like, that's a culture problem. That's
absolutely a
business problem. Right. And so there, I see a lot of that of like, well, this is my job security, is my knowledge. Why am I going to give this away? And two, yes, a lot of times it's those individuals are just not equipped to transfer knowledge.
Yeah.
They're not teachers.
Yeah.
They're not managers. They are individual contributors. They've been that their whole career. And there's a ton of institutional and knowledge, but they've never been equipped in how to teach and mentor somebody that. And so, I mean, a lot of the most stuff that I've learned has been through weathering the storm through those individuals of like, hey, look, I have to go above and beyond to get this knowledge from you. And some of it's by taking lashings, some of it's by watching. But like, not everybody is going to be that persistent to get through that.
Right? Absolutely.
And so the most successful organizations I've seen are the ones that have institutionally built in to their culture, transferring knowledge, process, driving process, and like, we educate our people. We can onboard somebody with entry level experience or none.
Yep.
Hey, you guys have the raw talent. We're going to teach you what you need to know.
Yep.
That's how Boeing, that's how auto manufacturing, that's how all of them do it. But the rest of us, the majority of the industry, the smaller shops, focus on people.
Yep.
We're dependent on people. And unfortunately, we don't realize it until that person's about to retire, how dependent we are on those people.
Yeah. And you know, the Boeings, the Northrops, those large scale manufacturers, Honeywell, whatever you want to, you know, whatever large manufacturer you want to put out there, they have the luxury of being able to have a bench. You know, they're lucky enough to be able to have farm systems if you're into baseball and sports, right? Those 20 person shops, they can't afford to have a bench, right? They can't afford to have that farm system. So they're depending on apprenticeship programs. They're depending on recent graduates. They're depending on other ways of transferring that knowledge. And depending again on the type of manufacturing, that's going to dictate how long somebody's ready, right? You look at some of these CNC on the precision manufacturing side, it can be 2 to 3 years before you've got an apprentice that is got their you know, certificate, their apprenticeship certificate. That's a long time to keep somebody in your facility, paying them a wage and not necessarily see a return on that investment, right? Not necessarily see good parts, not necessarily be able to put them out there. And that's where those younger stage of life programs are such a big deal, right? That's why early education in these programs is such a big deal. But I want to go back to one thing you said about ingraining it in the culture, right? Culture, you know, you walk into organizations and I'm sure you've had people on this show that we have a culture of winning. We have a culture of innovation. We have a culture of learning. It's not just a one-time event though, right? You can't just say I have a culture of learning and have it be true, right? That this is a process. And you said that very well earlier, but you've got to make sure that the people you're hiring value those things that you're putting up on your wall, that you're saying is your culture, because everybody needs to pay rent right now. Everybody needs to buy groceries right now. Gas is expensive. Everything's super expensive. People are putting up with a mismatch in culture a lot right now because they need that paycheck, right? Because they need those dollars. So they're putting up with it. When the economy turns itself back around, and we all know it ebbs and flows. That's just a cycle of our economy. When it turns back around, people will start job hopping again, unless you're making sure that those are aligned with the things that they truly value, right? And so the companies that I've seen that are successfully retaining people, not just recruiting, but retaining people, are the ones who include their employees in the design and development of their mission, vision, and values so that they are connected with the words that are up on the wall, right? Those people on your shop floor, again, regardless of what kind of shop you have, wood, metal, fabric, food, those people have to feel a connection to those words that are up on your wall, or when they have the next opportunity to go, they're going to go.
Yeah. And I think, a good test of this is if you bring an applicant into your organization and you set them free to go talk to whoever they want, are they going to come back feeling that that's true of what you say your culture is?
Right.
Or are they going to find conflicts with what you as the owner say your culture is? Because, I mean, that's the reality. Your culture is what happens, what your people
Absolutely.
Experience. And so if you're saying, oh yeah, we invest in learning, we invest in that, and then they go and start talking to the people on your floor, they say, well, actually, I haven't gotten any training. I haven't gotten any time to learn. And I don't know the last time, well, that's the reality.
Yeah.
And I think, but it's a snowball thing that reinvests in your people, because if you're not learning, if you're not investing in consciously, one, if you're not prioritizing, it's not going to happen.
Sure.
Whatever it is, right?
Yep.
And if you are waiting until somebody you didn't expect to leaves, and then you suddenly have to spin up. It's just like marketing, right? Like, okay, I need sales. You don't want to start selling the second you realize you need it.
Yeah.
And you don't want to start teaching the second you realize you're losing your people.
Yeah.
And two, especially in manufacturing, we have to make the product we make. And so if you're entirely dependent on one or two key people,
yeah,
those people can't take vacation. Those people can't go have a baby. Those people can't, move up when you need them to, because they haven't trained anybody. And so I think there's a scarcity mentality, a lot of it, as you mentioned, because of the history of our industries. But when you have that mentality and you're scared to invest in people because they might move on or because we might not work out, you're making the decision then that that's what you're not going to invest in. There's not going to be improvement there.
Yep. Absolutely. Absolutely. Well said.
Shifting gears a little bit, you talked about this a little bit when you first started sending out those cold emails and the pushback you got. And I think it was, talking about the soft skills and things don't belong in our industry. And I think that also, like, now there's some hot button words of, it used to be like affirmative action and now diversity, equity, and inclusion. And I think it very quickly gets politicized. But can you talk a little bit about what your thoughts on those? The pushback you hear from that and what the reality is from your perspective of the positive impacts and what we should be focusing on.
I mean, what we should be focusing on is real easy, right? Is humans and making all humans feel welcome in our industry, right? And so on the podcast, I recently launched an episode, and got some feedback from some listeners. I used a term in one of my episodes that wasn't as inclusive as I had thought about, right? And I didn't think anything about it at the time. Not many people did. This was months ago. I released an episode yesterday or recently, depending on when this comes out, on Lighthouse for the Blind. It's a company, organization up in Seattle, Washington, that takes low vision, visually impaired, and deaf-blind individuals and teaches them how to be machinists. So I got a lot of people from that community listening to the podcast. A couple people went back a couple months, listening to other episodes that were highly ranked and heard me say something about blind spots. And so I got some messages from people who were visually impaired about the inclusive language that I wasn't using, right? Why don't you use words like caution areas instead of blind spots? Oh, that makes a whole lot of sense, right? And it's just, it's not that I was intending to not be inclusive. I didn't know enough, yeah. Right? And I tell you that story, Jacob, because I think that a lot of the lack of inclusive language in this industry, I'm not going to say all, because there are some people who purposely use non-inclusive language, right? But yeah. I think the majority of people who are using language that is not termed as inclusive are not doing it on purpose. They are doing it because they are not aware of how it affects other people when they say things like that, right? Right. And so, you know, inclusivity, equity, diversity, the DEI initiatives, I think are super important. Affirmative action, I think in the theory of it was very well thought out. I think like all things that are done by government, the execution may have lacked, right? But ultimately it wasn't meant to replace anybody. DEI is not meant to replace anybody. It's meant to offer spots at the table for all, right? And so when I look at DEI initiatives, when I look at inclusive language, when I look at affirmative action, when I look at soft skills, things that are, as you pointed out, often politicized. As a white dude in my 40s, right? Middle-aged white dude, my job is to listen. My job is to learn. My job is to hear what other perspectives are saying, right? I can have an opinion, but I'd rather form an opinion based on how those other human beings feel about those initiatives themselves, feel about the opportunities or lack thereof that they're receiving, right? This, not to go back to the podcast, but this season on the podcast, February was all about Black journeys. March was all about strong women in the industry. April, all about these mission-driven organizations. Trust me, the previously incarcerated humans that are looking for jobs in this industry, they're not looked at very favorably, but they're human beings too, right? And I'll tell you, the Rise Up Industries episode that's airing at the end of this month, at the end of April, I actually tear up in the middle of that episode because this guy's story is so heartwarming, right? We're all just human beings. We're all just trying to make it. We all just want an opportunity. And manufacturing, if we could, for the most part, get out of our own way, can provide sustainable, generational, curse-breaking wealth for a larger group of people in this country than we've been targeting for the last 20 to 30 years.
Yeah. No, I know. I appreciate you giving such a well-thought-out response to that. And I put you on the spot because those are loaded questions and topics in our industry, to say the least. But what I'm hoping people take away from this and hear is because, and the episode before this, if everybody listening goes back, I spoke with Jillian Kleiner. She's a woman who changed careers in her 30s from commercial real estate, joined the Carpenters Union, worked her way up through the shop, and came in as a minority that, you know, everybody, her family, friends, everybody thought she was crazy. What are you doing going to work on the shop floor? And now she's a senior product specialist at a software company in this wow. industry. And she says, I felt more welcomed in the Carpenters Union than I did in commercial real estate. But if you go to those two places, you're going to see far more women and minorities in commercial real estate than you will in the Carpenters Union.
Right.
Why is that? And so when we talk about diversity and equity and inclusion, you know, from my perspective, the goal of it, any of these initiatives, regardless of what you know, the political side of it is
sure.
Okay, when we look at the makeup of any industry, let's just talk about manufacturing. When I go in the shop floor and when I go through all these organizations, it's very diverse.
Yeah.
Very diverse. But as you get further up in these organizations, it's less and less diverse.
Yep.
Why is that?
Yep.
Okay. And when specifically the carpenters unions and when you look at millwork manufacturing, a lot of this historically is not that diverse.
Yep.
It's very important that what you said is that we don't let our instincts of offense, like this is an indictment of me because I'm involved with this, and or the intention, but the results are what matter. And if the results are not representative of the population,
yeah,
and if we're hard up for talent, we should be doing everything we can to not have entire swaths of the population feel like they don't belong,
yeah,
to the industry.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of good people out there that we should be doing everything we can proactively to have women, to have minorities feel like there's a place for them and they're not avoiding applying to begin with because they see it and say, oh, well, that's not for me.
Yeah.
Because that is not, it is for them. It is for everybody and it is an inclusive environment, but a lot of times it doesn't appear that way. And it's because of the results. I mean, I just got back from an industry conference. Everybody looked just like me.
Yeah.
Like I was mistaken for 12 other guys because they all just look like me, you know, bearded, you know, middle-aged white guy. And you know, like when you take a step back and look, it's easy to get offended and be like, well, it's not my fault. I didn't invite these guys here.
Right.
But the results are the results. And so is there something we can do proactively? I mean, I follow Nush now from your episode.
Yeah.
And I love seeing what she's doing and posting about. And there's so many other stories like that.
Yeah.
That's what we want to promote.
Yeah. And early on in the podcast journey, I tried to do a LinkedIn live once. I'll never do it again, but I did one. And on that LinkedIn live, I had a conversation with Alex Marcy, who's a good friend of mine. He's in the integration space, the software space. And he had been at a show. He owns a company called Corso Systems. He had been at an industry event, manufacturing integration event. And his takeaway was exactly what you just said. I looked around the room and everybody looked like me. And he went home and he was talking with his wife and said, how do I go to these events in the future and not have that happen, not have that be the reality? And she said, well, you need to be more intentional, right? About who you're hiring. You have the opportunity to hire differently because you're the owner of this organization. So he looked at his company at the time. And he didn't fire anybody, right? He didn't let anybody go. But the next time he had a job come up, he intentionally went searching for people who didn't look like him. Mm-hmm. And now he has an organization that I want to say he has 60, 70% women, people of color. I mean, people who don't look like you and me, right? Mm-hmm. When I was putting together the guests for this year, for the Manufacturing Culture Podcast, I looked at the guest list from last year and a lot of them looked like you and me, right? So I was very intentional. That's why I started my Black Journeys Month, my Strong Women in Industry Month, my different months. And I'll tell you, that was great. And those months were great. And if people listened, great. I know people listen, people had fun with them. You just mentioned Nush. I mean, that young woman is a freaking rock star. But I was challenged by somebody on Instagram. They saw, it was the first week I had a gentleman, the first week of February, I had a gentleman out of Milwaukee on the podcast. And he grew up in a poor part of Milwaukee, rough neighborhood. But man, Courtney Tate is an amazing human being, right? And he goes out and he talks to these young Black men about careers in manufacturing. He's doing amazing things. I was very proud of that episode. I put a lot of posts up on Instagram, on different social media channels. And I had somebody who's not in our industry, who I've never met before in person, a Black man who is rather prominent on social media, on Instagram, he reached out to me and said, I hope this isn't you tokenizing just this month, people of color. And so I had to pause again, right? This is all a journey for me. This is all a journey for all of us. I had to pause again and say, huh. And so I started looking through the rest of my year and the calendar and guests. And, you know, April is all about softwares that create cultural change. Am I representative of people in the software industry, or have I just said yes to the people who came to me who look like me because they're comfortable coming to me, right? So I had to say to a couple of people, I said, hey, I'm going to move you to different points in the year. I need to make room in this month for somebody else. And that's fine. People were okay with it, right? And if they weren't, I don't really care. It's my show. I can do whatever I want, right? But now I'm more intentional. And I think that's going back to your original question about DEI. Diversity, equity, inclusion needs to be done with intent for it to be able to work, right? You have to understand that if you're not intentional about DEI metrics and programs, those are going to fall flat on their face because people are going to see straight through them as just being fluff. But if you're truly intentional about making change, that will come through as well. Just going back to that. Sorry about that.
No, I think that is, you know. That it's not me and Jim, who are not the most diverse panel to be talking about this, dictating, right? But I think that the point from that is that, okay, if you are trying to be intentional about this and you are trying to pursue this and say, well, are we doing everything we can, and you're not listening to those voices that are a representative of the industry, I think that's important. So like you listening to your audience, listening to people reaching out to you and saying, hey, I'm from this audience that you're speaking to. I'm from, you're talking about the blind audience, right?
Yeah.
Listening to those people, right? Listening to the Black audience if you're doing Black History Month and people of Black voices, right? And I think that it's without those people in your organization, you can't speak to that. You can't have those voices. And I think that's really what's more important, is that understanding that, okay, like if we're saying we are open to diversity, we're open to everybody. And because a lot of the pushback that happens from this, and I know there's going to be people in the comments or people, you know, listening to this and they're shouting at the screams like, oh, well, yeah, you're intentionally hiring minorities. That means you're not hiring the best of that position.
Right.
And that's really the biggest pushback people have, is like, oh, affirmative action, diversity, equity, inclusion is not hiring the best. And I think if you truly believe that hiring the best, unbiasedly hiring the best, results in white men in every role, then you don't know what hiring the best actually means.
And right.
That is not what we're talking about. And so that's the point, is that when the results don't represent what actually is in the population, that's what we're trying to combat against. So if one, you're listening to this and you're screaming at your screen, you're like, Jacob, you guys don't know what you're talking about, please send me a message. I would love to have you on the show. I would love to talk to you and have you educate me. I know Jim is of the same mindset.
Absolutely.
So I'm so excited to have you on here, because I'm looking to you as spearheading this and blazing a trail that I'm trying to do a better job of myself.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate the compliment, man. And like I said, it's a journey. I'm nowhere near there. I've got a bookshelf over there. My ears are always open. I read a lot of the comments. I go to spaces where people who don't look like me are to learn from them. And I am not 100% there. I never will be. I mean, I learned something from my wife every day about what it's like to be a woman. I have no fucking idea what it's like to be a woman. So all I can do is take that in. It's not that I need to say, well, not all men do that, or not all white people are that way, or not all chubby middle-aged white dudes are like X, right? It's me hearing those stories, those perspectives, and saying, huh, that's a really shitty time that you've had. I'm sorry you had that experience. Let's work together and collaborate and make sure it doesn't happen in this space, right? That's all you and I can do at this point, right?
Yeah. Bringing this all back to culture, the work you're doing, you know, the consulting you do with many companies, and kind of the future, what do you see in the industry related to culture changing over the next 5 to 10 years?
Ooh, that's a good question. Over the next 5 to 10 years, I see the culture. So there's something that exists right now called the culture automation paradox, right? The culture automation paradox basically states that the companies who need automation the most are not culturally set up to be able to receive the automation they need to really succeed, right? So I see that paradox over the next 5 to 10 years really closing quite a bit, because a lot of the issues and reluctance to bring automation into manufacturing because of cultural issues is because of older leadership, older generations that don't see the value in automation, that aren't ready to make a cultural change within their organization. So as those organizations start to change hands from generation to generation, or sold, or whatever the case may be, we're going to see an influx over the next 5 to 10 years of much younger owners within this industry, much more diverse owners within this industry, much more accepting owners of different stages in life, different human beings themselves, but also of different technologies that can really help propel those organizations forward. So that, to me, that's the most exciting thing that we'll see culturally over the next 5 to 10 years, is the acceptance, the embracing of the automation, and creating spaces where automation isn't looked at as a challenge to one's job. It's looked at as a way to upskill the workforce to provide better sustainable futures for all.
Awesome. No, yeah, I agree. I mean, it's interesting because I see a lot of the startings of that in millwork, is we're seeing some turnover in ownership and kind of passing on the guard to the next generation. And with that comes a little bit less of like, oh, are we going to accept automation, and more of like, that's an assumption that's just built in, and how are we pairing that with talent?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
On the flip side of that, what do you see staying the same and not changing? What constants do you see continuing?
Our industry, manufacturing, will always need humans. We are an industry that will never be one that has to say, oh my God, is ChatGPT going to take our jobs, right? AI automation will never replace humans in manufacturing 100%. It may take repetitive jobs and make them less repetitive for humans. But we will always have a human element in manufacturing, again, regardless of vertical, that will never go away. When CNC machines first came out, people thought, oh my God, they're going to replace us. Did not replace CNC machines, right? It just changed the way that the machinists, and there's still manual machinists out there, right?
Mm-hmm.
A lot less of them, but they're still out there. We're still going to have people who have to run CNC manual machines. We're going to have people who run CNC machines. We're going to tend robots, cells, routers in the woodworking space, right? Chisels and planers are not going away in the millwork industry. The human element is what makes millwork an amazing industry to be in. You can't get some of the amazing detail that a human can put into millwork without the human element, right? So that's the constant. That's forever going to be part of, and until we start with like cyborgs and humanoid type robots, which I don't think I'll see in my lifetime. Maybe I'm wrong. But I don't see them even being able to, you know, C-3PO is not going to be able to put some of the detail that some of the people in the millwork industry can put into the work that they do, right? They're craftsmen for a reason. So humans, we're the one constant, and we always will be.
Awesome. Well, Jim, I really appreciate you coming on today and sharing with everybody. I appreciate you having such a real conversation with me. For anybody who's interested in your podcast or the work that you do with culture and manufacturing, how can they reach out? How can they find out more?
Yeah, absolutely. Jacob, thanks for asking. I've actually recently gone through a branding change. So you can find me at themfgconnector.com. Or you can find me at themanufacturingculturepodcast.com. Also on LinkedIn, Jim Mayer. I'm in a giant brass bathtub with a bunch of orange ping pong balls. You can't miss me. So those are the best ways for your listeners to get a hold of me.
Awesome. We will make sure to link those in the show notes for everybody so it's easy. Go give him a follow. Go listen to his podcast. You're doing great work. And I look forward to having you on again in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. And I can't wait to have you on mine as well, Jacob. This was a great conversation, very natural and authentic. And that's my favorite kind of podcast to listen to and favorite kind to be on. So appreciate you hosting such a great show.
Awesome. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. Do you want to stay up to date about industry insights, new content, and our community of mill workers? Go to DuckworksMW.com to sign up for our newsletter. I'll see you in the next episode of Verify in Field.